Hello and welcome to another instalment of History Hack. I have Charlie with me today, who we've just decided that she has to call herself Charlotte professionally because Charlie White sounds like a 60s gangster or cocaine.
It's a tricky balance to pull that one, Alex. Yeah.
The fact that you don't look like a complete cokehead must help, though.
It does help. It does help, especially, you know, being a chef definitely helps.
So, who have you brought with you today?
I've brought a 17th century history friend.
It's a surprise.
You know me, if you get me on here, I'm always going to be a massive 17th century nerd. So today I have brought with me Jonathan Healy. He's an associate professor in social history at Oxford University, working on poverty, economic development, popular political history and rural history, covering the 15th to the 19th centuries. Of course, we all know the 17th is history's greatest century, so we'll be hanging out there. I first saw him speak at the rather fabulous HistFest back in 2018, I think it was, and I've followed him on Twitter, where he's at Social History Ox ever since, and he's very kindly agreed to come and let me be a nerd with him. So hello, Jonathan.
Hi, Charlie. How are you doing? It's really nice to be on here. And I'm always slightly cringy when someone reads out the thing on my website, which basically says I do all history from about 1400 to about 1900. Everything. It's all mine. Whereas in fact, I actually do a teeny tiny part of that, almost entirely focused on the 17th century. So it is one of those cases of you know, how I present myself versus, you know, actually kind of small thing that I actually do. But thank you, it's wonderful to be on. And I remember that history, that HistFest talk very, very well, actually.
Yeah, it was really good. HistFest is fantastic. For anyone who's
listening. Big up Rebecca.
Yeah, we love Rebecca. She is just fantastic. And it was such a great event. It was such a lovely random association of speakers, different eras, different topics, and you could just kind of wander around London and hear talks when you could be in person. So hopefully that will be up and running again soon in real life.
Absolutely. But it's good, because if you'd have mentioned the Tudors and gone closer to the 15th century, she may have just muted you and booted you out of the chat. Charlie's on a one-woman mission to eradicate the Tudors from history hack is concerned. She's like, we've all had enough. They can go away now.
Oh, mate.
They are quite well known. I mean, they've sort of had their time, really, haven't they? I mean, I don't want to irritate my colleagues, but it's a bit boring.
You don't want to irritate.
I didn't mean that.
Hold my drink, bitches.
we love the Tudors, but it's time for the sequel, isn't it?
Right,
we're ready.
Yeah,
we're ready to move on with the franchise, which is what we're doing today.
Well, I like to think of the Tudors as the prequel to the Stuarts rather than the Stuarts as the sequel to the Stuarts.
Nice.
That puts them more in Phantom Menace territory than
yeah,
you.
Exactly.
You in like Shallow Hal 2 territory. Yeah.
Oh,
we're Empire and their Attack of the Clones, I think, is the
yeah.
I like that. Everyone knows Empire's the best film. We'll have to check with Chris Sams on that.
It's not. The best film is Rogue One. And I'm not sure where that fits in with the English history, but it's kind of, you know, we digress.
Well, I love it. Be Rogue One, because that's me, and then I feel included. Let's ask some questions, Charlie.
Go on then. Okay, so what we're going to be talking about today is, and you rightly pointed this out, Alex, every time we talk about something 17th century, we always start with saying, oh, and of course, we all know that the king had his head cut off, but we've never actually gone back and talked about why that happened. We've touched on the Civil War. We've never really talked about why that happened. So we thought it'd be a great opportunity, because we've got John here with us today, and we can actually talk about how this all got started and discuss the king's downfall. So the Civil War didn't come out of a vacuum. Fighting didn't just break out by accident in the summer of 1642. So, John, where do we need to begin our story when we start talking about King Charles I and his parliament coming to blows?
It's a great question. And the first thing to say is that as soon as you go down any road of trying to explain what happened in the middle of the 17th century, you are going to annoy people who have a different take. So much so that even the name of the conflict is a contested one. Some traditionally it was seen as the English Civil War or even the Great Rebellion, if you didn't like what was going on. And then, of course, many people pointed out that, well, actually, there's also stuff going on in Scotland and Ireland. So today we think of things, we have names like the Wars of the Three Kingdoms, or my personal favourite, which is the Wars of the Atlantic Archipelago. love the word archipelago, and any opportunity to use it is wonderful. But
it's not going to look good on a t-shirt, though, is it?
Fit that on a badge.
So we don't know what it's called. So that's a bad start. And things get worse as soon as we start to think about what caused it, or indeed what people were fighting for. I mean, the people at the time didn't really know what they were fighting for. I mean, they knew what they were fighting for, but they didn't know what everyone else was fighting for. And so you get someone like Thomas Fairfax, who was a parliamentarian general. He was shown a copy of Magna Carta and sort of said, ah, this is what we were fighting for. This was very, very important. And then you got Oliver Cromwell, who sort of said, well, it wasn't really about religion. And then Thomas Hobbes, who says, actually, it was about religion. And so, even at the time, it was an incredibly complicated question. Historians haven't helped the situation. I think if you put two 17th century specialists in a telephone box and said, I'm only letting you out of this telephone box, and in fact, I'm going to put a fart bomb in there, I'm only letting you out of this telephone box if you can sort out why the Civil War happened, they would come to blows. It's like the old Dennis Wise thing about starting a fight in a telephone box. They would come to blows, and they would come up with four different interpretations, and none of them would be able to agree on any of that. All of that is to say, I don't know. However, although I don't know,
which episode ends.
I'm off now. I'm gonna make a cup of tea. However, I would like to suggest that there are some things that that we can say were important, and I'm going to highlight three. And what I normally do when I'm teaching is I'm going to highlight three, and then halfway through I'm like, actually, no, I'm going to do four, and then it's like, maybe I'll do five, but I'm going to stick to three, and if not, you can mute me.
All right.
And the first is religion, and I think this is the thing that perhaps is most alien to us. We are perhaps not as well, I don't want to be controversial, but I don't think we're quite as religious a society as they were in 17th century England. Not to be controversial, and the big question is, what kind of Protestantism England's going to embrace? Is it going to be a sort of very kind of ceremonial kind of Protestantism with lots of bowing and lots of lots of ceremony and lots of hierarchy and lots of images and things like that, or is it going to be a much more sort of homely one where the focus is on listening to sermons? So the first of those is the sort of it's the sort of royalist one, basically, and the second of those is the sort of parliamentarian one, and it seems like quite sort of. Those seem like quite sort of pedantic distinctions, really, but people at the time saw them as incredibly important. And so there's kind of two different cultures of the church. And it's one of these things where, how today, if you get two people who kind of broadly agree about something and then you put them on social media, and then gradually their positions get crystallized into opposite poles. And by the end, they're sort of, yelling at each other, telling each other to leave in no uncertain terms. It was a bit like that, where you get basically everyone's a Protestant, but because they're all arguing with each other in the press, they end up basically taking these kind of quite strong polar opposite positions, with one side calling the other Puritans and the other side calling the other Papists. So that's bad. So that's one thing, that's religion. And I think that's really, really important. It's a bit distant to the way we think about things, but that's fine. I think the 17th century, what I like about it is it's a bit weird. that's fine. The second is constitutional issues. And where this comes from, really, is that in the 17th century, lots of states are finding it very, very hard to pay for themselves. And there's lots of very, very kind of deep rooted reasons for this. The most fundamental is that there's lots of inflation, so tax is basically worth less than it was 100 years before. And while at the same time, warfare, which is of course the main thing that governments do in this period, is becoming more expensive. And that's because of things like gunpowder weapons and larger armies and what have you, all that kind of military stuff. he says, sounding very, very serious historian.
Military historian in the room fringes, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's fine. And so what that means is that Charles, when he wants to raise money for his government, he's forced to do it in ways that basically piss people off, because he has to use things other than Parliament to raise money. So by the late 1630s, Charles has been ruling without Parliament for a while, because Parliament got a bit aggy with him over all kinds of other things in the 1620s, but he's still trying to raise money, and that means that he's in this position where he's just about getting by, but if anything kicks off, then he's going to be in a lot of trouble. And then of course he makes the mistake of picking a fight with the Scots, and that's my third factor, which is the difficulties of ruling three very, very different places: England, Scotland and Ireland. And Charles quite likes to sort of order things and put things together and make sure everything is the same everywhere, which is a very, very bad idea. His father, James, was quite happy to, well, broadly happy to just sort of go, yeah, do you know what? I know Scotland is a bit different. I'm just going to let them get on with it. Charles doesn't do that. He wants to impose his own prayer book on Scotland. And that ends up with Scotland kicking off into a massive, massive rebellion and eventually invading England in 1640. And of course, Charles has got no money to pay for it, so he's forced to go back to Parliament. Are you following? There will be a test.
I've genuinely been making notes.
Good.
Nerdy notes.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant.
Totally, totally following. So Charles is trying to raise money. One of the sort of more controversial things he does to raise money is ship money.
So Charles, one of the things that Charles is quite keen on is getting control of the channel and making sure that the English fishermen have lots of places to fish. Now, where have we heard that before? Who could possibly imagine a government being so silly as to do that? And in order to do that, he needs a big fleet. And so ship money is an attempt to pay for that fleet. It's actually pretty successful. It's a bit of a myth that it's a complete failure. But what happens is that he extends it to inland counties. Traditionally, it was only levied on coastal counties. He extends it to inland counties, and they, of course, don't want to pay. And you get places like York saying, you want us to send you a ship. Have you looked at a map? Do you know where we are? We're not near the coast. We can't do that. But ship money is successful, actually. It raises quite a lot of money. It's only when Charles then picks his fight with the Scots, with the Scots Covenant, as they're called, that people stop paying ship money, and they sort of start saying, well, actually, do you know what? Let's leave this off. And he's helped by the fact that he's able to win a famous lawsuit. I mean, I'm quite amused about this idea that the king is forced to sue people in his law courts in order to get something done. You know, you don't sort of imagine, you know, a great tyrant having to sort of get lawyers to argue your case in the law courts, but he doesn't. But he's successful. Ship money is kind of, you know, it is considered legal, but it is very, very controversial, and it's one of the first things Parliament gets rid of when the Scots invade and Charles is forced to call another Parliament. That's in 1640.
I think this question, Charlie has written this question, she's the queen of the understatement. Parliament have expressed some concern about those around the king. He may have been getting some bad advice. Who were these evil councillors, in inverted commas?
Well, there's really kind of two big ones, and these guys basically become sort of hot potatoes, if that's the right phrase. And the first is the Archbishop of Canterbury, William Laud. We talked about how religion was a big dividing factor, and Laud is he's again I'm gonna annoy my colleagues here. Laud is the sort of classic classic stuffy Oxford Don who just annoys everyone. We all know them. And he's had a sort of long career out of annoying people. In the 1630s, you see what happens when you, I'm in a room with a modern historian. I start saying things like the 1930s.
Confusing stuff.
As if that's history. sorry. Anyway, so he spent the 1630s basically annoying the other side of the religious debate. He's quite old by this point. So one of the main things that Parliament wants to do is they want to get rid of him because he represents a very different tradition in the church to the one that most of their members support. The other is a guy called Thomas Wentworth, who is a sort of a stocky, curly-haired Yorkshireman who, again, is someone who just has a lot of difficulty making friends. He's spent most of the 1630s managing Ireland, but also he's a sort of the king's fixer, if you like. And one of the things that's really, really bothersome about Wentworth, or the Earl of Strafford as he becomes, is that he's got a pretty good idea that some in late 1640, that some of the leading parliamentarian members of the opposition in Parliament have been in collusion with the Scots. Again, that's a sort of very modern sounding thing, isn't it? Collusion with a foreign power, isn't it? But he is pretty convinced that he knows that some of the leading figures in the parliamentarians have been in collusion with the Scots. So people like John Pym, who I'm sure we're going to talk about. So with that in mind, they are desperate to get him out of the picture because he's very, very dangerous. So what happens is they have him arrested in Parliament very dramatically, very early on when Parliament sits in November 1640. And then in the spring of 1641, he's put on trial. And that trial it's a massive kind of, well, I mean, it's in many ways, it's a massive cock up because what they try and do is they try and say, okay, we'll admit that it's quite hard to get you for treason, but we're basically just going to add up all these annoying things that you've done and say that cumulatively that is treason, because what it does is it annoys people about the king. I mean, it's a bonkers argument, really, and Strafford knows it, so it doesn't get anywhere. So instead, what they have to do is they have to use something called a bill of attainder, which is pretty nasty. Basically, Parliament legislates and says you're guilty of treason. I mean, can you imagine that? They just sort of say, right, the Commons says, right, you're guilty of treason. Sorry, the Lord says, yep, fine, whatever, and then eventually the King signs off on it, and you can
die now.
It was. So
yeah. Yeah, and you're dead now.
That's it. But of course, I mean, but one of the reasons it becomes so such a sort of controversial thing, though, is that you can imagine Charles was pretty reluctant to sign off the head of his main henchman, and so he doesn't want to do it. But what the parliamentarians do is they use the crowd in London, and of course the crowd is able to think for itself, of course, as well, and so you get these kind of big demonstrations in London, and Charles is very, very scared for the for his family and for his own safety, and that means that he basically signs Strafford's death warrant. So it's kind of, you know, it's a great exercise in popular protest, if you like, but it really does kind of push people into opposing camps in 1641.
Gosh, and he did do everything he could to save Strafford. I read that he sent the Prince of Wales into the Commons to ask for Strafford's life and to ask them to back off. And he was about 10 at the time. So it was sort of this last ditch attempt of sending, I'm going to send my cute 10-year-old heir to try and get them to back off.
Yeah, he does try, and he's very, very. There's a story where he gets visited by Strafford's ghost because he's so, he's so kind of like, you know, he's so cut up about what had happened. But eventually, he just doesn't have a choice. You know, he's faced with a very, very powerful popular protest in London. He still has to pay for Parliament because otherwise the Scots will march south. So he's absolutely stuck at this point. And that's the case throughout the first year of what eventually becomes called the Long Parliament. Charles basically doesn't have much that he can do. He has to go with the flow. He has to, you know, declare ship money to be illegal. You have to say ship money really carefully, don't you? He has to declare it to be illegal.
Not on History Hack, it's fine.
You're fine.
With a smutty podcast, it's great.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Okay. I didn't realize this was the kind of thing I was letting myself in for.
There wasn't that in the T's and C's.
So yeah, so he's absolutely stuck, and that means that, you know, he has to basically do things that he really doesn't want to do.
There's another evil advisor, inverted commas, who Parliament had a problem with, who Charles is perhaps even less able to do anything about, and that's his wife.
Yeah. Often misunderstood, actually, but yeah, Queen Henrietta Maria was a pretty intelligent, pretty canny operator, but of course she was Catholic, and you know, when you've got a world where there is this religious debate and the kind of temperature has risen so much that one side is calling the other Puritans and the other side is calling the other Catholics, any kind of obvious Catholicism at court is a bit of a bother, and you know, some of the parliamentarians are absolutely mad when it comes to Catholics, and there's a real kind of anti-Catholic bigotry in some of them. There's one guy called Sir John Clotworthy, who's an utter bigot. I mean, I can't stand him.
He's, sounds like a Dickens name, doesn't it?
It doesn't. Yeah, yeah. He's Irish, and one of the things he suggests is that all Jesuits in England should be castrated.
Seems reasonable.
It's just mad. I mean, fortunately, it causes laughter in the House of Commons. There's another moment where the allegedly, I mean, we're kind of getting this secondhand, but allegedly, John Pym, who is the sort of leader of the parliamentarian side in Parliament, he suggests that Catholics should be forced to wear badges. Again, there's laughter in the House, and they think this is just stupid. But these kind of ideas are out there, and you know, there's a really kind of sharp edge to a lot of them. Parliamentarian. It's not just about, you know, fighting for democracy. There's a real kind of anti-Catholic bigotry, which is a major driving force there at the time.
Gosh, and that doesn't go away anytime soon. No. What can Parliament actually do about the King and these evil advisers and the personal rule and everything? Can they actually do anything about it? Can they give the King a piece of their mind?
Well, they do, and I think one of the big stories, basically, as 1641 progresses, is that the parliamentarians kind of push things a little bit too far, and there are people who see the Strafford trial and think, well, actually, do you know what? I signed up for a bit of moderate reform, a bit of you know, let's pull that Lord fella down. He's a pain. Strafford, I don't particularly like. What I didn't sign up for is all these horrible Londoners running around chanting and having political opinions. This is appalling. And then in late summer, Parliament has to go into recess because there's plague in London. And one of the last things they do is they pass this declaration, which basically says that all of the innovations in the church by Lord can be taken down in the parishes. And what people do across the country, especially in London, is they take this as an opportunity to go into churches and smash things like stained glass window, smash things like altar rails, all that kind of thing. And it's all very unruly. It's all very kind of, it's all very disorderly. And you sort of imagine these kind of, you know, relatively socially conservative MPs who've come from deepest, darkest Dorset. I don't know why I'm picking on Dorset, but I'm going to pick on Dorset. And they've ended up in Westminster, where they're suddenly in this kind of town, which is full of protesting, petitioning poor people who can all read. And at the same time, there's all these kind of what they call mechanic preachers, which is not Pimlico plumbers sort of going around and giving off sermons, but it's actually not that far away. it's basically kind of people who are you know, in trades, taking it upon themselves to just sort of stand on a tub and preach and give sermons, and Londoners, they lap this kind of stuff up. They think it's great, but if you're a sort of, you know, if you're that kind of huffy gentleman from Dorset, I don't know again why I'm picking on Dorset, poor Dorset,
they can't fight back.
Yeah.
Just, to be fair, Zach's from Dorset. This is a disclaimer. No Dorset people were harmed in the making of this podcast.
And you're sort of looking at that and you're thinking, this is absolutely not what I signed up for. I signed up for moderate reforms, not Pimlico plumbers standing on a barrel and shouting to me about the end times. That's definitely not what I'm in for. So by the end of 1641, Charles is able to tap into this kind of social conservatism and build a royalist party. So if you look at Parliament at the end of 1640, almost everyone is kind of a reformist. They want reform. By the end of 1641, it's a split down the middle. And worse, the House of Lords, who even more socially, even more of them are from Dorset, they are even more socially conservative, and they are blocking they're blocking legislation coming out of the Commons. So if you're on the reformist side, if you're John Pym, who we keep mentioning but we haven't actually spoken about, if you're John Pym, then you're passing things in the Commons, but they're getting stuck in the Lords. So increasingly towards the end of 1641, there is a blockage. There are royalists and they are getting in the way. It's very annoying of them. You know, we're trying to have good reforms here and the royalists are telling us that no, because it's socially disorderly and all that kind of thing. So by the end of 1641, there's a bit of a blockage. Again, call out Pimlico plumbers and they'll sort out your blockage. In this case, they've helped cause the blockage. I'm not sure where I'm going with this metaphor. I think I'm going to leave it there and move on.
No, I think that's good. It's like social media, isn't it? I came here for the cat videos and now I've got some, you know, conspiracy theory that we're all getting microchips put in, you know, all these crazy Pimlico plumbers loving it. So everything is a complete state.
It is. But can Charles, let me say that again. It is, but can Charles beat his parliament at their own game? Did he have a voice in the Commons?
Yeah, so by the end of 1641, things are pretty much split down the middle. And so basically what we're kind of spoiling for is a big fight, a big split. In the winter of 1641 to 1642, which someone at the time described as the maddest Christmas that I've ever heard, that I've ever seen, all hell basically breaks loose. And I think, you know, one slightly serious historical point, I'm going to make a serious historical point. We talk about the English Revolution or the Wars of the Three Kings or whatever. And if someone talks to you about the revolution, they normally mean the regicide, which is what eventually happens. I know we had a spoiler.
Spoiler?
Earlier. Yeah, spoiler. So you said it at the very start. You said Charles. spoiler alert, he gets his head cut off. It doesn't grow back.
The Apple podcast stats are going to show everybody switching off at this exact point. Oh, screw
maybe
that and ruin it.
Dead. Who knows? Maybe he'll just be Jon Snow.
Worst of Light of Beauty. Yeah.
I haven't seen the end of Line of Duty, so don't give me any spoilers. Although I did go into the supermarket and literally the ending was on the front page of the Sun. So that's rude. Anyway, I digress somewhat. So basically kind of get this kind of massive crisis at the end of 1641, and both sides are sort of playing for control of Parliament, control of London. The context, though, is that things have got dramatically worse because there's a huge rebellion in Ireland. Ireland has been ruled as a colony for God knows how long. I should know as a historian. No, but it depends on how you define it. Obviously. I'm making
lots and lots of years that Dorman's really angry about.
There exactly, yeah. And then, so in 1641, there's a big rebellion in Ireland. And what that means is that someone, or they believe in England, that someone has to raise an army to go and put down the rebellion in Ireland. And both sides, parliamentarians and royalists at this stage, don't trust the other to control an army. The other thing to say at this point is that the Scots have gone home. So Charles is in a stronger position at the end of 1641. And it's all basically going to come down to this question of who controls London and who controls Parliament. And so Charles in that winter makes a big play to control Parliament. And the first thing he does well, it's not the first thing. One of the first things he does is he has a big procession into London, which is which kind of shows, you know, look at me, I'm the king, and lots of Londoners go and support him. And then quite soon after that, he passes he gives a royal order which says all MPs must come to Parliament. Now that seems like a weird thing feels like a weird thing to do. But if you think about it, lots of Conservative MPs have gone home and not come back. So what he's basically saying is he wants all the Conservative MPs to come back into Parliament. So then he'll have a majority in both the Commons and the Lords. And then that's when things start to really kind of kick off, because the opposition, you know, Pym's lot, starts to think, well, you know, what can we do about this then? We're in a bit of a situation here. What can we do about it?
Yes.
Oh, you want me to explain what they did about it? Okay, fine.
Yes, yeah, no, I want to know.
I thought I'd leave that as a little.
What did they do about it?
Thank you.
I was listening so intently. I wasn't even thinking about asking questions.
Well, what they did was they appealed to the people. So a few weeks earlier, they passed this thing called the Grand Remonstrance, which was basically a big litany of all the bad stuff that Charles had done and what they thought that he should do about it. They initially, Parliament had said that we won't actually print it, but then they just wrote up manuscript copies and dished them out anyway, which is a bit weird. But in December, they printed it. So it was an attempt to appeal to the people, and you know, it kind of, in a way, it was sort of confirming all the biggest fears that that the Conservatives had. But they realised that the big issue was that in order to get anything done, in order to get control of the situation, and particularly to get an act passed which gave them control of the army, they needed to get control of the Lords. And what was blocking them, the blockage in the Lords, we've got more blockages.
Need a Pimlico plumber.
Well, we do, yes. The blockage in the Lords was John Pimlico plumber. Sorry, I just realised an awful pun. You'll have to edit that bit out because it's terrible. An abomination against
the Lords. May.
But they realised that what's blocking them is the bishops, and the Catholics. They're still Catholic lords in the House of Commons. In the House of Lords. And so at the end of December, there are big crowds coming out in London, basically kind of hassling the bishops as they try and go into the House of Lords, and, you know, haranguing all the Catholics who are kind of going through in their coaches, and there's big popular demonstrations. Charles makes the situation worse by trying to put one of his most loyal supporters, who's also a complete nut job, in charge of the Tower of London. He's a man called Thomas Lunsford. He's from Sussex. So we've offended Dorset. So let's offend Sussex now. Lunsford is a man who has a conviction for homicide, I think. He's quite happy for people to think he's a cannibal. during the war against Scotland, he'd shot deserters with his own hands. He's a complete, I mean, you know, just a very, very bad man.
Sounds like a thug.
A thug, that's the word I'm looking for. A thug, a hooligan. The kind of person one sees on the terraces at West Ham.
We can definitely insult them.
Yeah, definitely.
So Charles tries to put him as the lieutenant of the Tower of London, which is a very, very big, dangerous provocation, because he's got loads of guns there. But there's massive demonstrations. Eventually Charles backs down. But in the course of those demonstrations, the bishops basically lose it. One of them then writes a petition, if you like, which is then signed by a load of other ones, which basically says that Parliament is not free anymore because of all these demonstrations. Because demonstrations have been going on outside Parliament. Parliament is not real. It doesn't count. Best of three, I guess, is what they're sort of saying. So anything that Parliament has done around about that Christmas is invalid. And what this does is it means that the Lords, who take this as a great offence, they just get really huffy about it, kick out the bishops, and the bishops are sent to the Tower of London. So you get at the end of December a massive swing in Parliament, where you've gone from a situation where Pym and his lot can't get anything done because of the bishops in the House of Lords, to a situation where, because of those popular demonstrations. They've got control of both the Commons and the Lords. So now the scene is set for Charles to really kind of kick things off. But in Charles's defence, and you know, many of you will know what he did next. In his defence, he's been suddenly put in this very, very difficult situation. So he has to raise the temperature a little bit. He has to have a go at getting control back, take back control.
We love a three-word slogan here. Yes, I think it is time that we need to talk about Mr. Pym, who we've touched upon several times. It's very easy to think from caricatures of this particular era that it's King Charles versus he who shall not be named in a battle grudge match to the death.
Protector Palpatine, I think.
Yes. Cromwell's not a key player at this time. Who is? Who are our key players in Parliament?
Yeah, well, I mean, Cromwell's a bit of a non-entity at this point. I mean, he does pop up, but no one pays him much attention. Apart from this sort of royalist who rather sniffily remembers many years later that he gave this kind of crap speech in which he had blood on his collar because he cut himself shaving. I think the idea was...
Loser.
Yeah, this kind of East Indian ruffian, basically. They didn't have much time for Cromwell, but he's just not very important at this point. He's, you know, a minor figure until much later. The key player really is John Pym, who is a notably humourless MP. We have lots of historical records about John Pym, but I don't think there's any single record of him ever enjoying himself. He's a sort of Blackadder Puritan, basically, who, given half the chance, would be sat in the House of Commons on a spike. he's also vehemently anti-Catholic, but also a man with an extremely nerdy understanding of parliamentary procedure, and someone who knows that the important thing to do in Parliament is to make sure that you're on good terms with the Speaker. So he's quite a canny operator, but he's at this point he's sort of driving the reformist agenda so much that people call him King Pym, which is a bit of an insult because, you know, they think that he's kind of, you know, trying to take the kingship, which is fair enough. There's also a load of other key players in Parliament. Two of the crucial ones are John Hampden. He's the person who ended up getting sued by the king over ship money. So he's a bit of a hero of the parliamentarian side. And a guy called Denzil Hollis, who is actually a socially conservative MP from Dorset. So he's
he is.
when we're being read about people from Dorset. But at this point, he's like a sort of classic radical, really, in that he starts off as very radical and then gets older and gets much more conservative, particularly as everyone else becomes more radical around him. But at this stage, he's very much on the sort of on the radical side. There are various others, and eventually, what Charles decides to do is he decides to launch treason accusations against five MPs. Pym, Hampden, this is where I have to remember them all, and I always get them wrong. Pym, Hampden, and Hollis are the three key ones. He also goes after two guys called Arthur Hazelrig and William Strood, I think that's how you pronounce it, who are slightly more obscure but are just basically people who have pissed Charles off at one various point, quite sort of vindictive. And he also has a go at one of the Lords, a guy called Montague, later the Earl of Manchester. And Manchester, or Montague at this time, is a very canny operator, but importantly he's got this house in Chelsea where all the parliamentarians are meeting and plotting. So Charles decides to try and decapitate the opposition, not literally, well, eventually literally, I suppose, but for the time being, not literally. So he launches treason accusations against them. And he does it in Parliament on the 3rd of January. The idea is A, to kind of get these people out of the picture, but also to slow things down in Parliament, to tie them up in knots dealing with this case. Well, eventually all those Conservative MPs will start coming back, but then for some reason he decides to change tack on the 4th. Now the context here is that throughout that winter, while there's all these demonstrations going on in London, Charles has been gathering soldiers in Whitehall. So Whitehall is now basically a kind of big barracks. Whitehall is it's a palace at this point. It's a bit more than you know, the sort of vaguely kind of dull buildings that you get now. But the area basically around the banqueting hall is where one of the main royal palaces are. And throughout the winter of 1641, Charles has been gathering these soldiers. They're called cavaliers, which is important because, of course, you know, stuff. So he's got all these cavaliers around him. And at some point on the 4th of January, and it's at some point in the afternoon, probably, possibly after he's received a massive bollocking from the Queen for basically being a bit of a wet flannel, he decides that he's going to get a load of soldiers and he's going to march down to Parliament and he's going to arrest the MPs in person because they're currently kind of faffing around and no one has bothered to arrest them. And so that's what he does. And it's all a bit of a debacle, really, to start off with. I mean, he comes out of Whitehall. As far as we know, I mean, sources are a little bit kind of, you know, this is a long time ago, we don't quite know exactly what happens, but it seems like what happens is he basically kind of flagged down a coach. There was some poor noble or some poor gentle person was kind of trotting along in a coach, and then suddenly you get this kind of, you know, long-haired king, probably in high heels, coming up to you, sort of, you know, tapping your window with a cane and saying, "Excuse me, sir. Can you
take—" It's like the ubiquitous scene in a Hollywood movie where York cabbie of an ethnic minority gets harangued into the plot line.
So he gets in this coach and then he sort of trundles slowly down what's now Whitehall at the pace of a snail. Meanwhile, this lookout that the French ambassador has run down through these crowds, weaving in between these crowds, and has managed to get into Parliament and say, "Guys, you might want to know what's going on." And so what happens is the five MPs basically leave the House of Commons and kind of hide in the building. One of them, Stroud. He's a bit of a Devon wide boy, and he actually wants to stay and fight, but he's eventually kind of pulled away. So so he's kind of pulled away, and they eventually kind of end up getting on boats. So Charles goes into the house. He leaves. He's got about 500 soldiers with him. He leaves most of them out in the yard. And he takes about 80 of them, and they sort of wait in the lobby, and they're kind of peering through the door going, "Look at my sword, you know, look at my pistol, look, it's cocked." While Charles goes into the house with his nephew, Charles Louis, Elector Palatine, and says, "Right, folks, where's the five MPs? Can I have them, please?" And the speaker, who's a guy called William Lenthal, who's a bit of a drip, to be honest, but suddenly finds this kind of stirring moment of defiance, basically says, "I can't, if I have eyes, then I only have the eyes of the house, and I can't hand over these men." So Charles gets increasingly cross and sort of, you know, and he says, "Well, I can see the birds have flown," and then sort of walks out and swears and goes away. It's sort of quite comical in some ways, but if you think about it from the perspective of those MPs in the House of Commons, they think the whole situation is going to get very Scarface very quickly, because they can see outside these heavily tooled up cavaliers, and they think there's going to be a massacre, so they are terrified, and as a result they basically eventually adjourn the House of Commons for a week, and they re-meet in the City of London. Charles, by this point, realizes that the five members have gone and have hidden away, and they've gone down the Thames into the city. And so the next day he goes into the city and addresses the Common Council. And then he's again surrounded by protests. He's surrounded by angry citizens, all shouting, "Privileges of Parliament." They had great chants back then. "Privileges of Parliament." And at one point, he's sort of trundling along in his coach again. And this ironmonger throws a pamphlet into his coach, which basically has loads of biblical quotations saying, "To your tents, O Israel." It's a reference to deposing kings and armed resistance to monarchs. So Charles gets very, very frightened by the whole thing, goes back to Whitehall, and then within a few days, he decides to leave London, goes down to Hampton Court, and eventually down to Windsor and then up to York. So it's a crucial moment because Charles basically gives up on his capital. And you know, I said a few minutes ago, the winter sees a battle between both sides to try and get control of the Parliament and control of London. And eventually Charles bottles it and ends up leaving. So you've got kind of two armed camps. The other interesting
Thursday, hasn't he?
Yeah, no, definitely. And the other interesting thing is that in these kind of tumults, as they're called, it's a great word, tumults. You talk about Charles with his cavaliers. The other insult which gets thrown around at this point is Roundhead, because lots of the London crowds are apprentices, and apprentices tend to have short hair, and lots of them are also Puritans, and Puritans tend to have short hair at this point. So the insult Roundhead gets used, and you get these two sides kind of basically firing insults against each other. So it's a critical moment in that split between two sides.
Sovereign and Parliament still commemorate this, do they?
So there is a theory that the whole thing with the black, with, sorry, it's not yeah. the, it's Black Rod, isn't it? Where he bangs on the door and slams it in his face. It's supposed to be a reference to this, although it's quite hard to actually prove that's the origins. But yeah, I mean, it's one of these things where the myth is kind of cool. So let's keep the myth. I like the
myth.
Let's
do it.
Yeah, it's supposed to commemorate this.
We're only historians. We're only the guardians of
exactly. Hey,
never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Exactly.
So how do you think he feels scampering north? Total failure. Right? Total failure.
Well, I mean, yeah. In 1642, Charles is a bit disappointed at how many people actually come and support him. And as he goes to York, he basically, not that many people come and join his cause. And then he has this debacle where he tries to get into Hull, which is where all the military stuff. Again, military historians are going to be appalled by this. Guns and swords and all that kind of malarkey. They're all in hell after the Scottish War. And Charles tries to get them, and then he's told to bog off by the governor, who's been.
Can you imagine being turned away from Hull?
it's not my point in his career. His career had a lot of low points. Getting his head cut off was one of them. Being turned away from Hull was another. But eventually he makes the very sound decision to sort of start trundling around Lancashire, Cheshire.
Actual loyalist area as opposed to Yorkshire, yeah. Which you're always yeah. kicking off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the Welsh marches and all those kind of areas where he gets lots and lots of support. So by the time it actually ends up in battle, he has a very, very strong army. But again, I mean, you know, after the Battle of Edge Hill, which is the first major battle of the Civil War, Charles is able to march to London. And yet again, he's told to piss off by a load of Londoners, because they all come out. Well, they don't all come out. Lots and lots of them come out and block his pathway at Turnham Green on the district line. And Charles is not able to get some, and it's one of those great sort of collective moments where all the London militia, who are all kind of fairly ordinary guys, basically come out and sort of stand in Charles's way, or in the way of his army. And all the London women kind of bring out picnics and everything for the soldiers and bring out ale for them. And it's sort of great, you know, collective resistance to Charles. So once again, he's kind of been foiled by those pesky Londoners getting in the way.
I like the fact that I do not have a lot of respect for that branch of the district line, and I like that its uselessness is actually provable as far back as the 17th century.
It is true.
Yeah, he's not the only person who's ever got stuck on the district line, in the district line.
Not on that right? Richmond yeah. bit, no way.
So why on earth did Charles think, you know, strategically speaking, that it would be a good idea to leave London?
I think he realised that he'd lost it, so it was almost a sort of a reflection of reality. But I think he wanted to go to the rest of the country and raise the salt of the earth English folk against the metropolitan elite, and who were all terribly radical and annoying.
Make London great again.
Well, yeah. So, but I think he realised that a lot of his support was from the loyalist areas. It is a bit surprising that he went to York first. But in hindsight, he should have gone to Shropshire, which is one of those counties that we haven't insulted yet.
Get to them all. Don't worry.
Yeah, we'll get there eventually. But so he should have gone there first. But I think he thinks that he's got a lot more support in the rest of the country, which he does, although it's more split down the middle than you might imagine. And I think he then thinks that he can get support from the rest of the country and then eventually come back and take London. So it is a sort of he wants to fight back against the metropolitan elite, I think, with their lattes.
And their avocados.
You visiting bastards.
Do you think money played?
I'm going to recruit the Greggs Mafia.
Oh, I love that. I was going to say, do you think money played any part of that? Because, I mean, York is, it's not short of a bob or two. Maybe he thought that the bishops of York might help him out a bit.
Well, yes. I mean, he also gets lots of support from all the kind of, well, not all of them, but lots of the aristocratic families, the universities as well, particularly Oxford, gives him a load of money. They melt down loads of their plate and then give it to him, which he turns into coins. So he realizes that the sort of big financial institutions of the city, not just the sort of bankers, but also the East India Company as well. He realizes that he's basically lost them and they're not going to give him any money, partly because they don't like him very much, but also partly because they're pretty canny and they realize that he'll probably just lose it. In order to get support, he needs soldiers and he needs cash. And he's pretty conscious that he's not going to get that from London. So he's pretty sensible, I think, to try the rest of the country and see if they're a bit more supportive of him, see if they'll respect his authority in the way that those horrific Londoners with their ideas about social equality and all that kind of thing.
Wasabi takeaway and all of that crap. Do you think that the attempted arrest of the five members made war inevitable, or could Charles have done anything to smooth relations with Parliament?
It's a great question. I wish I knew the answer. I used to think that it was the Irish Rebellion that made war inevitable.
Just make an answer up. No one will mind.
Yeah. No, it was the aliens, actually. What many of your listeners will not know is that later in the year, aliens came down. No, I mean, I think, yeah.
Yes, but that's basically how someone started a religion with Scientology and people bought it.
And people started some very, very strange religions in the 1640s as well, although I don't think any of them would to do with aliens. I think probably it did. I think, one of the things that you need in a civil war is you need two sides who are basically kind of armed camps glaring at each other. And you've kind of already got that in late 1641 at the very end, because you've got Parliament with their guard at Westminster, and then you've got the King with his cavaliers at Whitehall. So you've already got these kind of two armed groups, if you like. They're almost like, they're sort of just yelling at each other down the street, basically. But what happens when Charles leaves London is that he's able to raise a bigger force. And of course, London does the same. They have the Earl of Essex, who's one of their leaders. He's kind of trotting around in a rather sparkly coach. He's very flamboyant, as the Earl of Essex, for an alleged Puritan, and raising the London militia. So you basically get two sides which are able to raise armies, and you do. Call me a traditionalist. You kind of need two armies to fight a civil war. As I say, I think it's one of those questions that you get to historians, you'll get five different interpretations. I think it's a fair one. I think on this afternoon, at this time, I will say yes. If you ask me again tomorrow, I might not. But for now, I'm going to say yes.
We know what happened next. And this is all sort of leading up to the raising of the standard in the summer of 1642 now. It's just incredible to see how those decisions and how those arguments and those back and forths actually escalated fairly quickly into a conflict.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there's a bit of a tendency amongst some historians who I'm not going to name To see it as all a bit of an argument between the members of the social elite. But in 1642, when you get these mass mobilizations of parliamentarians and royalists, you're basically using a mass mobilization of really quite ordinary people to settle a question about religion and the constitution. So it's a really kind of revolutionary moment, I think. And I think we shouldn't underplay that. It's not just about aristocrats and gentlemen arguing. It's about ordinary men and women as well, and making these decisions about which side to support, which side to fight for. As I say, it's women as well as men. When London throws up its defences, in the early stages of the war, it's a massive effort by London Londoners, including lots of London women, to just go get a spade and build these massive defences. All gone now, of course, now. But it's a huge, huge collective effort. So, you know, what happens, it's not just this kind of tiff between factions within the aristocracy. It really is a mass mobilisation about a really quite complicated dispute about politics and religion.
Gosh. We'll have to get you back on and do a proper myth busting of all the kind of A-level myths that you learn about the Civil War and actually break them apart. But at this particular podcast, John, we couldn't let you go today without asking your expert opinion on the recent findings at Cerne Abbas, which, for anybody who hasn't heard of this, he's the great big naked warrior carved into the hill down in Dorset. So what do you think is the link perhaps between one of our five members and a certain enormous member carved into a Dorset hill? Because I know you love Dorset.
I think you've been waiting the whole time for this. Come up with it. Yeah, I like
it. You know his cat well.
I'm not going to deny. I do like it. Yeah, you might think that there's no connection, but there allegedly is a connection, which is that Denzel Hollis, one of the five members, was a bit of a bigwig down in that part of Dorset, and in his later life, he fell out massively with Cromwell. By the time Cromwell became important in 1647, Hollis was very much on the sort of conservative side, whereas Cromwell was more on the radical side, and they fell out massively. Hollis eventually went into exile, but then Cromwell actually let him back. And there's always been a bit of a theory, because the Cerne Abbas giant doesn't appear in the records until, I think, it's 1694, so it's very, very late. So there's always been a bit of a theory that it's basically a big joke by Hollis, because Cromwell portray Cromwell as Hercules, and obviously as a Puritan, one of the things you probably don't want as a Puritan is a massive chalk hill figure with a huge erection. I mean, I'm no Puritan myself, but I'm going to say that that's probably not the kind of thing you
want. I think it's more hilarious, and we have more of a case to argue for it if the knob was on his head.
But unfortunately, the boffins at the National Trust have done some extremely clever scientific analysis, and they found that the Cerne Abbas giant is much older than that, as far as they can tell. It dates to the 11th century or there or thereabouts. Now, I have to say, as a 17th century historian, I'm immensely disappointed by it.
I also really hope that it was just a load of drunk guys on their way home from the local alehouse.
So the one thing I'm going to cling to, though, is that we still do have this issue of this thing was allegedly there for hundreds of years and no one noticed it until the 17th century. And there's also apparently there's some suggestion that the original version of the giant nearly had a belt and was slightly more decent than, shall we say. And honestly, if you don't know the picture, if you don't know I went there as a child. That sounds very, very weird.
I'm surprised the Victorians didn't come along and scratch.
He should be in Y fronts, shouldn't he, really? But anyway, there's a theory that the most striking element of the Cerne Abbas giant was put on later. So what I'm clicking with the story, here's my story, and I'm sticking to it. I'm sticking to it it's the thing was fine. Okay, National Trust, you can have your fun. Fine, Cerne Abbas giant, 10th century. I'll give you that. That's fine. Enjoy your moment of victory. I'm sure you'll be a better person for it. It then got lost. And then in the 17th century, it was discovered by someone connected with Denzel Hollis, who decided, this reminds me of Cromwell. So I'm going to draw a huge phallus in the middle of it as a way of taking the piss out of Oliver Cromwell. So that's my story. I'm sticking with it. It may well go against the science, but that's fine. And hopefully we can keep at least part of the Sir Nabus giant. One might suggest the most important part for the 17th century, but who knows?
Oh, John, thank you so much for coming on. I hope you've enjoyed your visit to the only history podcast where it's okay to make as many knob jokes as you like. and swear on everyone as well. Thank you so much for coming on and making what a subject that usually makes me want to slit my wrist actually fun and exciting for the last hour. I've loved it.
See, I told you.
still don't know what the fuck is going on with the shit money stuff, but yeah, I'm kind of halfway to understanding why now, but I still think he's an idiot for going to Yorkshire. Where's the only other place where you could have gone where they could have been more fighting? Oh, I'll go and visit Cornwall. Excellent, thank you so much.
Brilliant, my pleasure, it's been fantastic, and I hope you've all enjoyed yourselves.
You can help us at History Hack by joining us via Patreon. It takes quite a lot of effort and a lot of work of quite a big team now to keep us going. And so if you could donate as little as £3 a month, it would be massively appreciated by all of us. There's different levels because Princess Marcus has set it all up with varying rewards and things. So do have a look, do join us. There's an exclusive Facebook group as well, and you could be part of all of it.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/hackhistory, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.